Sounds True presents The Lost Mode of Prayer, Session 2 with Greg Braden.
Almost universally, ancient texts, prophecies, in these traditions, there is a reference to a mode of prayer. And again, this mode of prayer transcends science, religion, and mysticism as we know it today. We're reminded that it's a highly sophisticated technology that we embody as an awareness, as a consciousness. It's less about an outward expression and more about something we become. We're reminded that we have today and have always had direct access to the creative forces of our world through this inner technology that we call prayer. The ancient Essenes, in texts now that have been translated directly from the Dead Sea Scrolls, begin to describe this technology to us in the only words that they had, the only words of their time. They begin by reminding us that we live in three places. We experience this world through three modes of experience. They say three are the dwellings of the sons and daughters of man. No one may come before the face of the Creator or the God who knows not peace in each of these three: body, thought, and feeling. And they go on to describe body essentially as what they equate with emotion. They viewed emotion as being experienced in our bodies. So this is the beginning of a technology, and this is the first time in any of the ancient traditions I've seen this so concise, so clearly broken out and referenced in such a way that it allows us to go in and actually address them individually and merge them into a common technology. So we live in body, thought, and feelings. Now they go on to say that when these three become as one, when we find a way in our lives to reconcile our feeling world, our emotional world, and our thinking world into a single directive force in our world, that's when you say to the mountain, "Mountain, move away," and the mountain will move away. It has to move away. And this is the beginning of the Essene technology where they're sharing with us prayer. From their perspective, the ancient Essenes had a wonderful worldview and life view, very simple, very eloquent. They essentially view our bodies, the human form, as a mirror of parameters that we live in our lives. They defined six parameters. They said that our body simply is a resonator. It's a mirror of these parameters. When something occurs in our bodies that we choose to change, we simply look to one or some combination of these six parameters to change. The parameters are thought, feeling, and emotion, breath, nutrient, and movement. Well, through the ancient technology of prayer, we've addressed three of those parameters because prayer, of the many ways it may be defined, is the combination of a particular quality of thought, feeling, and emotion. So prayer may be defined as just that. It's a quality of thought, feeling, and emotion that allows us to tune our biological circuitry. Western researchers now view every cell in our body as a minute electrical circuit that transmits, receives, it stores, it has capacitance, its resistance, vector energy, scalar energy. These tiny circuits. Prayer allows us to tune our biological circuitry to creation. It's how we find ourselves either in tune or out of tune with the nature and the world that surrounds us. So from this perspective now, we're invited to allow for the possibility that prayer transcends religion. And I'm just amazed as I travel to cities throughout the West how deeply ingrained within individuals and families and groups the concept remains that prayer somehow is religious in nature. And I'll invite you, if you haven't done so already, to find your own journey and explore through these ancient traditions and these texts, now as the translations become available, and demonstrate this for yourself, that prayer is a communion between humans and the forces of this world, It transcends religion, and you begin to see where religions and religious dogma and the rules and the regulations were built around this technology. But prayer transcends science in the true sense of the Western world of science today, because prayer allows for possibilities that science cannot explain through the rigid dogma of the science that we see today. On the one hand, on the other hand, it's that rigid dogma applied in its completeness, in its entirety, that I believe will lead the Western world into the place where, once again, we're not discovering anything. We're simply redefining it in a language we're comfortable with. So it is that rigidity, that dogma, that will lead science into the place where they witness today phenomena they cannot account for. Their understanding of prayer, I believe, then will flesh out our understandings of our world and allow us to embrace an even greater worldview. Prayer transcends the mystical traditions as well. It's more than simply mysticism. It's all of these perhaps combined and bring us to a point where we may launch forward into a new wisdom that has no name as yet. What we can say is that prayer is an ancient and highly sophisticated vibratory technology. When I say that prayer transcends science, I'm often asked precisely what I mean by that. Perhaps some of the best examples come from the world of physics. And as I've studied some of the works of the great physicists, Max Planck, for example, what a brilliant man, a very brave man. When he accepted his Nobel Prize in physics, he made a statement during his acceptance speech that shocked the scientific community. And it was a tremendous insight into the place where physics had led him in his life. Essentially, what he said was that as a man who has spent his entire life studying matter, I can tell you this much. Max Planck said, there is no matter as such. Our entire world is made of succeedingly smaller patterns of vibratory fields, nested one within another within another. And beneath these fields, we must assume that there is an intelligence or a mind, and we call that creative force God. And one of the reasons he and other physicists have found these dilemmas in physics, especially in the quantum world, is because they reach a point in the subatomic world where the laws of physics appear to break down and something else begins to happen. The random principles, the way that forces interact with one another, there's something happening there. There's an element that's missing. Einstein knew this, and he referenced it many times as well. Perhaps as another example, let me just give you one more brief example, and we'll come back and explore this in more detail. It wasn't that long ago, there was a lot of discussion about a new form of energy that we called cold fusion. Cold fusion was in all the science magazines, the tech journals, and all of a sudden we stopped hearing quite as much about it. You'll still see articles every once in a while, and not as much. One of the problems with cold fusion is that the experiments did not work predictably every time they were carried out. Sometimes the cold fusion would occur, sometimes it wouldn't. And it took a group of very insightful researchers to actually go forward with a scientific method of control samples and experimental samples. And what they discovered was a surprise to them as well as the other researchers who were working. They discovered that when a team of researchers is in the room with a cold fusion experiment and that team expects the cold fusion to be successful, more often than not, it is. And when a team of skeptical researchers were in the room and they doubted that the cold fusion would work, more often than not, it did not. And the statistics were so high, they said there's something is happening here. And what it led them to understand was that their expectation of success or failure, their thought, feeling, and emotion was playing a role in the outcome of the experiments. And now we know that thought, feeling, and emotion are digitally measurable vibratory templates. They're a thing. They interact with our world. Prayer is the union of thought, feeling, and emotion. Prayer is a specific quality, a parameter of these thought, feelings, and emotions, allowing us to interact with the forces inside of our body as well as those beyond our body. So once again, prayer becomes considered as a very sophisticated technology. A few months ago, I was doing a program, and a woman in the audience asked me a question. She said, okay, I understand what you're saying. Why prayer? Why would we ever choose prayer? What good is prayer really in our world? What if we don't have prayer in our world? I'd never been asked that question before, and I thought about it for a moment. And this, again, was one of those times when I really had no idea of what was about to come out of my mouth, and I opened my mouth to speak, and these words tumbled out. And what the words said was that prayer is to our quality of life as water is to the seed of a plant. And after I'd said that, I stepped back and I thought about what I just said. And I said, wow, I like that. Now, what does it mean? Prayer is to our quality of life as water is to the seed of a plant. The seed of a plant is whole and complete unto itself, and it may exist in that form as a seed unchanged for thousands of years. We're now recovering seeds in earthen vessels from Egypt and the high Andes in Peru, and those seeds are still intact. Some of them will still germinate, and they're still a seed. In the presence of water, however, the seed is allowed to blossom to its greatest expression, the greatest potential of its life. And I believe that is true of prayer to us. We may exist, and we may walk through this waking dream that we call life in the presence of one another, day in and day out for 1,000 generations. And we are whole and complete and intact and enabled unto ourselves. And in the presence of prayer, the communion between us and the creative forces of our world, our bodies and one another, we then have the opportunity to blossom to our fullest expression, the greatest potential of what it means to be human. And that was the answer to her question. This is the value of prayer in general, specifically at this time in human and earth history, as we are on the threshold of this great change that is referenced by so many and also the subject of a lot of controversy by so many. Whatever it is that we're about to experience, whatever it is that's about to happen in our world, we are better suited to address the great challenges of our world as our most realized possibility. And I believe that's what prayer offers for us. Well, in our world today, our Western world, we have been conditioned in the last 1700 years to see ourselves as separate from the circuitry, if you will. If you view our world as an electrical circuit of living components that all work with one another to create the reality that we know, we've been conditioned to believe that we are separate from that, to view ourselves as separate and distinct from this circuit. What prayer allows us to do, it invites us to view ourselves, rather than being separate, as a component. We are part of our world. And this is so powerfully important. And the Essenes were masters at conveying this understanding. We watch the Nature Channel sometimes, or Discovery on television, and we'll see documentaries of researchers that go in to observe portions of the earth or to witness populations of animals. And that's our thinking, that we're observing and we're witnessing. The reality is that we are participating in. We are earth. We're not just part of the earth. We are earth. Our bodies are earth. The minerals, the water, the light, the air of this world is what our bodies are made out of. And we are a part of all that we see. Every choice that we make in every moment of life has some influence on the world around us, sometimes to a greater extent, sometimes to a lesser extent. And that's the value of the holographic model. In 1947, there was a brilliant researcher, actually a Renaissance man. He was a musician, a painter, a philosopher, an author, an artist, and a scientist. His name was Dr. Hans Jenny, J-E-N-N-Y. In 1947, Dr. Hans Jenny developed the apparatus that allowed us for the first time to witness the relationship between vibration and form. In his laboratory, under laboratory conditions, Dr. Jenny would take different materials. Sometimes they were liquid, sometimes they were powders. He'd project vibration into them. He would create vibratory sequences. And as he projected them into his equipment, he could actually see the pattern, see the geometry from the vibration, sometimes they were audible, sometimes they weren't, and they were all vibrations. And what he found was essentially this, that at lower frequencies, the patterns are very simple. And as the frequencies increased, the patterns became more complex. And that was the essence of what came from those studies, the many things he determined. The lower the vibration, the lower the frequency, the simpler the patterns, the higher the frequency, the more complex. Well, now what we know is that thought, feeling, and emotion are vibration. And as we have lower frequencies of thought, feeling, and emotion, our patterns are simple. As we have higher frequencies of thought, feeling, and emotion, our patterns are more complex. The more complex they are, the more opportunities those vibratory patterns have to influence the world within us and the world around us. Well, high frequency patterns from thought, feeling, and emotion are what we consider through the words love, compassion, peace, forgiveness. Those are considered higher vibratory patterns. Lower vibratory patterns, anger, rage, hate, jealousy, fear, all aspects of fear. So is it any wonder that through the ancient traditions, we're invited to embrace these higher vibratory qualities in our lives? Now, they didn't have the words to describe. They didn't know about Dr. Hans Jenny's vibratory apparatus and the science known as cymatics. They didn't know about maybe frequencies and waveforms. They shared with us in the only words of their time that our greatest attributes are drawn from deep within us through our expressions, compassion, love, peace, forgiveness. And now we've simply rediscovered that, redefined it through our own science in a language that we're comfortable with. What researchers now understand is that emotion actually provides the template for active DNA in our bodies, directly affecting our immune systems and our ability to reproduce cells. Okay, that's happening inside of our bodies. Researchers have also discovered now that emotion, vibratory template, has a direct linear effect on material outside of our bodies, on the world around us. Think about what that means. Is it possible the way you feel about your world or about something that's happened in your world, could it possibly have any effect outside of your body on the world around you? And the answer now is yes. In 1995, studies were conducted by the HeartMath Institute in Boulder Creek, California. It's very interesting the way they chose to perform these studies. They took participants out into nature, and they seated them in nature, and they placed probes at specific strategic locations on the participant and in nature. They had probes in the ground for 2 feet, 3 feet, 5 feet, 50 feet away from the person. They had digital measuring equipment where they could measure the effects on leaves of trees and on the bark and on the rocks surrounding this participant. And they would ask the participant to become angry. And in the anger, what they found was that the earth around the participant responded in one way, and in joy and compassion, that the earth responded in another way. They actually measured digitally the frequency response of rocks, trees, and leaves in the moment of what's called coherent emotion. In the moment where we align thought, feeling, and emotion into joy or into compassion, and the leaves and the trees and the earth responded, those frequencies were picked up by the probes within a 50-foot radius of the individual who is being tested. So if one individual, at least in that instance, under those conditions, what was happening within that individual was being picked up and influencing living and non-living forms of matter within 50 feet. Well, this is really interesting, and it led to another series of experiments that asked something even greater. That was hosted by the HeartMath Institute. They invited a Russian Nobel Prize winning physicist to the United States. His name was Vladimir Popanin. Why would they invite a light scientist to study the patterns and the effects of emotion in our world? from the world of quantum physics, our world is made of light. It's made of quanta. It's made of photons, little particles of light sometimes. Sometimes they act as waves. And our world may be thought of as being composed of these minute packets of energy that we call quanta, that are sometimes particles or waves. The question was, does our emotion have any effect on light, on the quantum world around us? So they devised some very ingenious experiments, and these were under laboratory conditions. The first experiment was to create a vacuum inside of a glass vessel, and they measured what was left in terms of light inside this vessel, and what they found was that the photons were scattered randomly throughout the vessel. That's exactly what they expected to see. The next thing they did was they took the same vessel now and they introduced a tissue sample containing human DNA. And to their amazement, what they discovered was that the photons actually aligned themselves to the patterns of DNA. Then they took it one step further. They removed the DNA. The net effect was when they went back in, even though the DNA was gone, the photons were still aligned to what had been there in the past. The effect now is known as the phantom DNA effect. Now think about what this means. At least in these conditions, in the laboratory condition, for the first time, there was a phenomenon that was demonstrated that's been referenced through ancient texts, ancient traditions for thousands of years. And now we come full circle with this technology. If human thought, feeling, and emotion dictate the arrangement of the DNA in our bodies, and the DNA in our bodies is now affecting the arrangement of matter outside of our bodies, then as we change our thoughts, feelings, and emotions, we change our DNA, and our DNA changes the patterns outside of our bodies. And we come full circle. Now we have the essence and the mechanism for a technology. Here we are moving through our world, perceiving through thought, emotion. We combine the two together and we have our world of feeling. Okay, our world of feeling, those are our beliefs, our perceptions. They create a measurable vibration that now is documented as ordering sequences of DNA inside of our bodies. And now, through the phantom DNA effect, at least under these conditions, that DNA inside of the tissue is ordering, it's coding matter outside of our bodies. And that matter is what we have our feelings about. And our feelings are what create the vibration for the ordering. Once again, we come full circle. This is the beginning of a technology that up until very, very recently, our science has not allowed for. And this opens up the door to vast, new, exciting possibilities, maybe a little frightening for some people, and very empowering for others. In 1997, I was fortunate enough, my wife Melissa and I, to lead a group of about 40 participants into Egypt. Well, something very unexpected happened. Somehow, President of Egypt, Mubarak, granted us access into temple sites and tombs and locations, many of which I have never been in my 12 years of going to Egypt. Some hadn't been open to the West for over 60 years, we were told. One of those sites was on the west bank of the Nile. It is an underground tomb that has a domed ceiling and is about 30 feet long by about 15 feet wide. And as we descended into the 200 stone stairs to get into this tomb and the lights were turned on, I could understand perhaps why it had been off limits for so long. Because as the lights came up, we were surrounded by images that were so brilliant and vibrant in color, it looked as if the artist had just left the day before. Impeccable, with many tourists and the humidity of their breath in a closed area. The quality of these images would deteriorate very rapidly. Well, it was on this particular tomb, on these walls, that I witnessed for the first time in my time of journeying into this part of the world, an image that had been referenced in many of the mystery schools to the Egyptian god Osiris, who's the god of resurrection, the god of eternal life, the god who transcended the polarity of time and space in this world in another cycle before our time. And at the end of this domed chamber, along the walls were all the experiences that Osiris had moving up to the time of his great transition. All of the experiences of life and the experiences of family and of gathering food and all the things that were happening. And at the very end, he portrayed for the first time that I've ever seen his secret in terms of how he transcended the polarities. For the first time, what we saw was the image of Osiris flanked and his shoulders by the sign of the Eye of Horus, through the Eye of Horus mystery schools, which we see commonly as the left eye. Rarely do we see the right eye. And he was flanked by both, the left and the right eye of Horus, representing the left eye and the right eye of Horus mystery schools. Horus, who was the son of Isis and Osiris, he was the product of their union. The left and the right eye representing the two mystery schools based in two very different, although closely related, philosophies. The left eye based in the logic and in the left brain knowing of our world. And that's the path our Western world has taken today. So we essentially have lived this left brain of Horus mystery schools through our societies and our technology. The right eye of Horus represents the feminine aspect, the intuitive, the feeling, the emotional aspect of our world. And in our technological society, up until recently, we've done our very best to circumvent that, to do anything we can do to stay away from the feeling and the emotional component. Well, here in this tomb, 200 steps underground, what we're seeing is Osiris is sharing his secret. He's saying in the only symbolism of his time, the secret to achieving and transcending this polarity, achieving this lasting experience, is the union of left and right brain, the union of logic and emotion. And once again, we see what we're reminded of so often through these mystery schools, that as great as our logic is, as important as our left and right brains are, they're incomplete. If we view the world through left and right brain, we'll always view the world in the separateness of left and right, light and dark, good and bad, right and wrong. That our logic must be tempered with the wisdom that comes from our hearts, the wisdom of the experience, the wisdom of feeling and emotion. And it's through that that we are able to transcend the great challenges of life. I've referenced several times these three parameters of prayer: thought, feeling, and emotion. What is the difference between feeling and emotion? In recent years in the West, we have merged the two into a single concept, feeling and emotion. The ancients, however, identified them as closely related yet separate. And what they said to us is this: that feeling is the union of a thought and an emotion. So if we're having a feeling, it's the union of thought and emotion. Emotion can be considered the power source that drives us forward through life. It doesn't have any direction until we apply thought. Thought may be considered as the guidance system. So thought by itself is impotent without the power to drive it. Emotion, power by itself, is impotent without the guidance to direct it. It's the union of the two that allow us our reality, the reality that we call our world. Another way of looking at this is thought may be considered imagination. Emotion may be considered desire. And when we find a way to merge our imagination and our desire into a single, directive, potent force, then we create our reality. So thought and emotion produce feeling. Feeling is the digitally measurable vibratory template that allows us to create in our world, and that feeling is the key component to the lost mode of prayer. Over the years, as I've offered this information to groups ranging from maybe a dozen or so up to several hundred, I've asked people a question. I've done an informal little survey regarding prayer. And again, prayer is deep and personal. It's a very sensitive subject for many people. And I just take an informal survey with a show of hands, and I say, when you pray in your world, what kinds of things do you pray for? And I made little lists, and I've compiled these lists after about 6 months, and this is what I've found. And I'm not suggesting that this is a good representation of our population. More often than not, people pray for more money in life, better jobs, greater health, and better relationships, and they do it in this order. Well, we can use these components of the prayers in a little demonstration, and I'll just do this quickly. It's very interesting the way this works. If we view the components of prayer as thought, feeling, and emotion, and our prayer is for more money, what is the thought underlying more money? And more often than not, the thought says, I don't have enough money. The reason the prayer is in place is because they feel they don't have enough. So the thought is, not enough money. Now, the ancients remind us, when they speak of emotion, that we are capable of two primary emotions, and all other emotions are expressions of those two primary emotions. We're capable of love, and whatever we feel that love's opposite is, whatever that means to us in our world. Okay? So, if we're praying for more money, our thought is we don't have enough, then I ask, what is the underlying emotion to that thought? Is it love or is it fear? More often than not, the answer is fear. It's the fear that there isn't enough to go around. Where's my mortgage going to come from next month? Something like that. So when we look at this technology, if we merge the thought of there's not enough there with the emotion, the low-frequency emotion of fear, we produce a feeling, and that feeling can have many words. It's kind of summarized as yuck. We don't feel good in our world because our thought is that we don't have enough of something, and the emotion is the fear of not having enough. The feeling is the vibratory template. That's what we put into our world to create. How interesting. When did we, in our inner technology, begin to create the feelings for the things that we least choose to have in our world in place of that which we most choose to have in our world? When did that happen? In other words, if our feeling, the union of the thought and the emotion, if the feeling is the vibratory template that allows us to create in our world, why not create with the feeling that which we most choose to have? What happens if we have the thought that there's plenty to go around and the emotion of what it feels like in that plentiness, the fullness of love, or whatever that means to you, creating the feeling of abundance? Well, the way that people respond to me in that moment is, yes, and it's not there. They say, why would we have a feeling about something that's not there, that's not present? That is the crux of the lost mode of prayer. Okay, so I'll ask you to hold that thought in mind just for a moment. Let's look at one more of these, and then we'll go forward very quickly. Better job. That was the second prayer. Better job. If we're asking for a better job, the thought underlying that is something like, the job I have right now isn't good enough. The emotion, is it love or fear? If it's not good enough, more often than not, we're saying that there's a fear that this job isn't good enough or this job isn't going to last. And the feeling bound that comes from the union of not good enough and the fear of not having enough, it's the same thing. It's that feeling of lack. It's the feeling that invites us to go through life in a contracted state of lack rather than the expansive state of abundance. And I think just from these two examples, as you're listening to this, you see a pattern develop and you get the idea. In the past, our conditioning is we have prayed in some respects, in some instances, for the things that we believe we don't have enough of in our world, and our prayer has been the prayer based in lack. How interesting. The ancients remind us, and this is one of the tenets that was lost 1700 years ago, in acknowledging that we are desiring more, what we are actually doing is consenting to the less. In acknowledging desire for more, we consent to lack. Energy follows our attention. How many times have we heard that again and again? Energy is focused now on the lack. And the question then comes up, have we fallen into the ancient trap of focusing our attention on what we do not have or what we least choose to have in our world? Think about what this means in your lives, in all of our lives, because we're in this together. We have this common conditioning in the West that only occurred about 1,700 years ago. How can we change that, and what does that mean in our lives? This gets really interesting. Historically, in the West, prayer researchers, there are people who have researched and compiled many modes and expressions and applications of prayer. One of them is Margaret Paloma. She has identified four modes of prayer, and researchers pretty much agree upon this in the West, that we use today. We use these four modes individually or sometimes in combination with one another. The first of those modes is considered to be a colloquial prayer. We speak to our Creator in our own words, informally. We describe the problems or we give thanks. Petitionary prayers. Petitionary are also informal. It's where we ask for specific things or specific outcomes or maybe better health for ourselves or for others. We're petitioning the creative forces of our world for that which we feel we deserve or that which should be so in our lives. Ritualistic prayers, the third mode, can be considered a repetition of some predetermined sequence of words. Now I lay me down to sleep, pray the Lord my soul to keep. That's a ritualistic, predetermined set of words, a ritual we go through at bedtime, or God is great, God is good. The fourth mode of prayer, and there are some individuals who consider this a non-prayer because it is meditative in nature. In the meditative form of prayer, it's where you move beyond words, you move into a stillness, you're aware of this holy, sacred presence around you, you become the empty vessel through which the wisdom of creation may find a place within your body. And for some individuals, the word meditation and prayer are mutually exclusive, and for others, meditation is actually a form of the prayer. Researchers pretty much agree that we use one or some combination of these modes of prayer in the West today. And as I examined these modes of prayer, it became very clear to me that through the ancient and esoteric traditions, they reference a type of prayer, a form or a mode that doesn't fit into any of these categories. And that's what led me to ask, is there a fifth mode? Is there a lost mode of prayer? And if so, where did we lose it? And what would our lives be like today if it were part of our knowingness? And that led us on a journey through the sacred texts and through some of the great libraries and monasteries, from St. Catherine's Monastery at Mount Sinai in Egypt into some of the esoteric translations here in the States, eventually into the monasteries and the nunneries in the highlands of Tibet, over 15,000 feet in elevation. And in those places, they all reference this lost mode. And the lost mode, the fifth mode of prayer, is a prayer that is based in feeling. Okay, remember, feeling is the union of thought and emotion. The fifth mode of prayer is a prayer based in the feeling that your desire is already accomplished, even if, maybe, you haven't seen it come to pass in your world. Let me share with you a story. In the late 1980s, the American Desert Southwest was undergoing one of the worst droughts in history. The rain had stopped in the early part of the year, and there was so little rain that the Rio Grande River, that normally originates in southern Colorado, dried up. And we didn't even begin until it got to the Red River confluence in northern New Mexico. Ski areas never opened during some of these years because there wasn't enough snow. And river rafting stopped. Fishing was down. The fish had to go somewhere else. They were migrating to places where there was more water. Well, I was living in northern New Mexico, spending a lot of time researching the indigenous traditions of North America. And a friend of mine met me for lunch, and we were having this conversation of the relationship between prayer and weather patterns. And in his traditions, the way he was raised, the way he was brought up, is that human emotion plays a large role in what happens with the weather in any particular geographic location. From his perspective, we were going through a cleansing, a purification. Some call it a tribulation at that time. It was a purification. And I said, are you suggesting to me then that through a change in emotion, it would have any effect on weather patterns whatsoever? And he said, you bet. Would you like to see? And that led us to a discussion and eventually to a little drive up into a valley in the midst of two mountain ranges. And we walked what to me seemed like aimlessly. He obviously knew precisely where he was going, through the sage and through the brush, through the tamisa. And we came upon a stone formation. It was an old medicine wheel that he said had been in this field for many generations. He says, we're not even sure who built it. It's always been here. Our ancestors placed it here. And I said, well, why are we here today? And he said, I'll use this medicine wheel as a focus. And it didn't have to have it. It's kind of like a tarot deck. It simply provides a focus for an inner knowing. And today, he said, the focus will be on rain in this part of the world. And I had an expectation. When I heard him say this, I expected I was going to see a dance, a ritual, maybe some sage burning, some incense, or something like that. And I stood back and I prepared to watch. And I was unprepared for what I saw, because not much happened. I watched him walk over to the circle. He closed his eyes in silent reverence. And then he turned his back to me and became motionless for a period of only minutes. And he walked back over to me and said, let's go, I'm thirsty. Let's go get something to drink. And I said, well, I thought we were going to do this prayer for rain. He said, well, I just did. And I said, that's not what I was expecting. And he said, well, what were you expecting? And I shared with him, and he laughed at me. And he said, first of all, let me explain something. He said, the moment you pray for rain, you have just promised it will never happen. And I thought about his words. With a little model, this eloquent little model that we just finished, now think about it. If we're praying for rain, and that prayer is a thought, feeling, and emotion, what is the thought under praying for rain? The thought is, there isn't any. The emotion, is it fear or is it love? Well, if there is no rain, your crops are dying, your animals are dehydrating, there's no fish in the lakes, good chance you're in fear. So the union of the fear of not having any with the thought there's not enough is the feeling that says we're in lack, and that is the template that would be placed into the world promising there wouldn't be any rain. And he corrected me lovingly. He said, I didn't pray for rain, I prayed rain. And I said, what does that mean? He said, I simply went over to the field a few steps away from you. I took my shoes off. He said, I closed my eyes and I had the feeling of what it feels like to have my feet in the soggy mud of my home and the land outside of my house, to feel that mud ooze through my toes. He said, I felt the smell of rain coming off of the mud walls of our pueblos in the springtime. I felt what it would feel like to walk through waist-high corn this time of the year, as it should be, so that we would have our crops. I smelled those smells. I felt the feelings. And I knew in that moment that I had just created that, and that became my prayer. Now, what he was saying, this is key, it's subtle and it's key. What he said was that he was taught in his conditioning to acknowledge the power of his thought, feeling, and emotion. It's what we call faith. Faith has a very different definition today than it does in those indigenous traditions. Of the many ways that faith may be defined, what we could say is that faith is acknowledging our power as a directive, potent force in the scheme of creation, rather than simply an observer witnessing, that we are part of creation. What that means is the moment you think, feel, and emote something, you just created it. Now, maybe it didn't happen right in front of your face. Maybe it didn't happen even on the horizon where you can see it. And that's not important, because in your faith, you trust your power and your wisdom and the gift that lives within you. And you know that on some level, somewhere in creation, the seed was planted that will allow that to come to fruition. And now the prayer becomes a prayer of thanks for what you just created, even if you can't see it. And that was what he did. That's why it only took a couple of moments. He had the feelings, the thoughts, and the emotions. He knew that he had created something. Then he gave the prayer of thanks, and he did many times throughout the rest of that day. He gave reverent thanks to the forces of this world, to the creation, for allowing him the gift of creation and allowing what it was that he believed he created. Well, we said goodbye that day and went home that night. Something very interesting happened. That night, a storm came into northern New Mexico. It was a freak weather pattern where this mass of warm, humid air came up out of the Gulf and touched a cold air mass coming in over the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, and they had more rain than they knew what to do with. And I watched on the weather map. It was amazing. Whether his prayer actually created that effect or not, I cannot say scientifically. What I can say is that story beautifully illustrates the concept, maybe in a more concrete manner, that I'm offering. How many times have we prayed for things? Is it possible in praying for them that we have actually participated in the not having of them? We embody a sophisticated technology. And according to the ancient Essenes, it's in this lifetime we learn to think the thoughts of angels and to do as angels do. They reference the angels as the highly evolved life forms that have transcended this world and live in other worlds. In their wisdom, they were able to transcend. Was it possible that there is another technology available to us as this fifth mode of prayer? So the fifth mode of prayer is about creating the vibratory possibilities of that which you choose to experience in your world and then giving thanks for what you've created. Maybe they'll happen sometimes, maybe they won't. What I do know is that in doing so, this is the union of those thought, feelings, and emotion, and this is us expressing that most sophisticated technology that we call prayer. Feeling. We talk about feeling. What is a feeling anyway? What we call a feeling is actually an electrical and a magnetic potential moving through our body. This electromagnetic charge is moving in fluids across the membrane of the cell walls very, very quickly. Feeling is us moving energy around in our bodies. And that's what this prayer is all about. Prayer is about creating a feeling and that feeling interacting with the energy that already exists within our bodies or within our world. So the Essenes actually left us an equation for prayer. If this, then this. If thought, feeling, and emotion are one, then the outcome is so. Now, this is a place where it's important for me to clarify. This mode of prayer is not simply a wish machine. What this mode of prayer does, it allows us to put into place the vibratory templates, the possibilities of an outcome. Okay, and it doesn't guarantee anything's going to come to pass, number one. Number two, whatever it is that we create through this prayer, we experience in our bodies before the world ever experiences. And in our world, we're conditioned to only have a feeling about something in response to what's occurred. We have a feeling when we go outside of a nice day because there's a nice day there. The sun's warm, the air is dry, the wind is out of the south-southeast at 7 knots, and it feels great this time of year. Okay, so we respond to that and say we feel good. Now, what if we walk outside and it's a little gloomy and a little stormy, and our tendency is to say, ooh, you know, this doesn't feel good. What if in that moment we choose to have the good feeling even if our world doesn't give it to us? That's our power as creators, because that elicits the possibility of that template in our world. It is the knowing, it's the feeling that it's already accomplished. When thought, feeling, and emotion become one, then our outcome is accomplished. With that in mind, I'd like to go back and examine some quotes that I found in some of the religious texts, perhaps a biblical text, maybe one of the Dead Sea Scrolls. In the book of James, in the King James Version of the biblical texts, the prayer made in faith will heal the sick. It's the faith that's already done. It's the faith that happened, and now this comes back to the two stories I shared with you this morning. The woman in the medicineless Chinese hospital with a 3-inch diameter cancerous tumor in her bladder that we watched in real time on a sonogram melt and disappear in 2 minutes and 40 seconds. The practitioners were embodying a thought, feeling, and emotion inside of themselves, and the outward reinforcement of that among themselves was them echoing the words, wasa, wasa. It's already done, already accomplished, already healed. It already happened. The healing was already accomplished, and now it was just a matter of time. The prayer made in faith will heal the sick. The example that I gave of the elderly man with his walker who missed the curb, crumpled into the parking lot with a gash just below his ear in the back of his head. And the woman that came over and stroked his wound only for a matter of moments, and it healed so completely, when the paramedics got there within 5 minutes, there was no wound. The blood remained on his neck, it was still staining his shirt, and there was no wound on his body. What did she do? She didn't buy into the illusion of what his physical body had shown him. The three Chinese practitioners didn't buy into the illusion projected through the body of the woman on the gurney in front of them. They knew that she is not cancerous, that she in her soul is whole and complete and as shiny and new as the day she burst forth from the heart of her Creator into this world. They knew that. And they also allowed for the possibility that through her choices of thought, feeling, emotion, breath, nutrient, and movement, her body is mirroring this illusion. So they didn't buy into the illusion. They created a new template. They said, already healed, already done. And that's what the woman did, as I spoke with her later, that healed the back of the man's neck. And here we see it now in a 2,000-year-old text. The prayer made in faith will heal the sick. If you wish, you can cure me. Matthew 8:14. If you wish, your wish becomes the thought, feeling, and emotion that's already done. Now, what I'll say next is key. All around the world, we have all heard the King James Reader's Digest condensed version, ask and you shall receive. For many people, they've tried that and they say prayers don't work. If your prayers have gone unanswered, this may shed some light and some insight into the reason why. Ask and it will be given unto you. What does that mean? When the translations were made from the original Aramaic and words were poorly translated, rearranged, and condensed, we lost a lot in those translations. Going back to the original Aramaic, retranslating without condensing, ask without hidden motive and be surrounded by your answer. Be enveloped by what you desire, that your gladness be full. So far you have not done this, and your prayers have not been answered. Let me say that one more time. Ask without hidden motive. Be very clear of your intent. Why are you choosing to bring this prayer into fruition? Ask without hidden motive. Be surrounded by your answer. If you're asking for abundance, see abundance all around you because it's already there. Be enveloped by what you desire. Find that abundance. Find that health. Find that joy, peace. There's already peace in this world. Be enveloped by what you desire, that your gladness be full, and give thanks for what's there. And that's how we perpetuate and create it on larger and larger scales. And now, through the holographic model of consciousness, we know that every time one person shifts their viewpoint from saying this world is falling apart and is about to blow up in global war, and looking at all of the individual possibilities of where that may happen, as we allow ourselves to view the possibility that maybe those little skirmishes are the last vestiges of an old paradigm, of an old thought form rearing its head asking for a greater healing, maybe that's what's happening right now. Give thanks for the peace that's already in our world And we're told, and I'm seeing this happen. I've seen it happen in the corporate world, in individual departments. I've seen it happen in corporate boardrooms. I've seen it happen within organizations. And I believe I'm seeing it happen on a global level now. And that's why now is the key time. If we're ever going to embody these possibilities, now's the time to do it. Because you're the generation that's chosen to bridge this time, the ancients called no time, to create the template, the foundation, the building blocks for all that's about to be for this generation and for future generations. This is the legacy that we're creating in this moment. So we're invited to give thanks and create that peace from the peace that we already see. Be enveloped by what you desire, that your gladness be full. If we consider the components of prayer, thought, feeling, and emotion, each is a vibratory template. It's a pattern. If we could project our thought, feeling, and emotion into a substance, we can actually see the form, the shape of that vibration. So in your mind's eye, if you will consider each of them as a series of concentric circles, for example, a concentric circle of thought, one of emotion, one of feeling. Unless those three parameters of thought, feeling, and emotion, unless those concentric circles rest one on top of the other, on top of another, then they are not aligned. And this is what the ancients reminded us. They said, when thought, feeling, and emotion become one, that's when we empower our bodies, our will, our intent to create in our world. So as those concentric circles move into alignment, one over another, that is our thought, feeling, and emotion become as one. Sometimes maybe we move two out of the three together. Maybe feeling and emotion in our world have become so merged that we consider them as one. And what do I mean by that? Maybe feeling and emotion are aligned and thought isn't. Well, let me offer this. Each time someone asks you a question, maybe it's something as simple as, how do you feel this morning? First thing when you walk into work on Monday morning, how do you feel? And your thought is, I feel fine, and that's what you say. And your feeling and emotion are reeling from some deep personal experience that you've experienced over the weekend, okay? In that moment, you just dishonored. It's not right, wrong, good, or bad. It's simply a path. You've dishonored that alignment because your thought and what you shared didn't mirror the feeling and the emotion. So you have not aligned the thought, feeling, and emotion. If we view thought, feeling, and emotion as vibratory templates and we think of them as a thing in that way, then it becomes clearer in our Western mind how they may have an effect on the world around us. So the question is, how do you do this? How do you do this thing? How do you align thought, feeling, and emotion in a world, in a society, in a culture that sometimes doesn't even support emotion as being discussed? How do we consider this as a technology? The Essenes, and again, we go back to the clarity and the wisdom and the beauty of the words of the Essenes. They were so clear. They asked themselves precisely the same question 500 years before Christ. They asked themselves, how is it that we do this in our bodies? And what the masters of that time said to them is the beginning of a technology. Listen how clear, how concise, it's even in a specific order. When they said, how do we create thought, feeling, and emotion as a unified pattern? How do they become one in our bodies? The master said to them, first shall the Son of Man seek peace in his own body, in his emotions. The emotions are where we begin. For his body is as a mountain pond that reflects the sun when it's still and clear. And when it's full of mud and stones, it reflects nothing. We must find that peace in our emotions to begin with. And again, they equated body and emotions as very similar because it's through the body that we're experiencing our emotions. So first, we must find peace in our bodies. Then, and this is exactly the way they say it, then shall the Son of Man seek peace in his feelings. We call on the angel of love to enter our feelings that they may be purified and that all that was before impatience and discord be turned into harmony and peace. So feelings are next. Then, through our thought, then shall the Son of Man seek peace in his own thoughts. For there is no greater power in heaven and earth than the thought of the Son of Man. Though unseen by the eyes of the body, yet each thought has the mighty strength. Even such strength can shake the heavens. And they refer to this again and again and again. They remind us that the inconsequential, what we believe are the inconsequential moments of our mundane lives, the things often we take for granted, have dramatic repercussions throughout the other worlds, throughout the heavens. They remind us that the choices we make individually each day in our personal lives rock the angels of the other worlds. They rock the heavens. They shake those heavens. It's an awesome possibility, an awesome proposition to consider. So what is the common thread? What's the key in each of these? They invite us to find peace in our bodies, peace in our thoughts, peace in our feelings. It's the ancient secret. It's the key of peace. The ancient key of peace in the perspective of the Essenes. They invite us to seek peace in all that lives, in all that we do, in every word that we speak for peace. They don't say that love or that compassion or forgiveness. Peace is the key to all knowledge, to all mystery, and to all life. It's in the presence of peace that we are able to have the compassion and to demonstrate the love on the deepest levels, and we're invited to seek the peace in everywhere, in every experience, in everything that we'll ever know in our life, because it's always there, even when it appears, maybe at first, that it's not. And to look sometimes, we've got to maybe turn over some stones and look around some corners to find it. And once we find that little iota of peace, that's the anchor point from which we can expand into greater and greater expressions of peace. Isn't it interesting? In the Essene traditions now, they remind us, they invite us, once again, to remember that three are the dwellings of the sons and daughters of man. No one may come before the face of the one, or of God, who knows not the angel of peace in each of these three, body, thought, and feeling. Once again, when these three become one, you'll say to the mountain, move away, and the mountain will move away. I have a story I'd like to share with you. It's a true life account. The first time I ever had any inkling, any insight into the power of thought, feeling, and emotion aligned in my life, I was in high school in the Midwest. I was 15 years old, and I had enrolled in a series of studies surrounding the martial arts. And every other day of the week, I had different forms of martial arts that I was studying. Tuesdays and Thursdays was a form of karate. It was a South Korean form of karate. One evening, we came into the dojo, into the room where the techniques would be shared. And rather than going through our techniques, our instructor invited us to sit onto the mat and listen and watch. And we did. And he said he would like to demonstrate something for us. He invited us to give him 3 minutes. He said, give me 3 minutes, and I'm going to close my eyes, extend my arm. So he was sitting Indian-style fashion. His body was erect, and his arms were extended directly out from his body, 90 degrees to the floor. And he said, give me 3 minutes in my prayer. At the end of 3 minutes, come over and move my body. Move my arms. And we thought, well, no problem. We thought we'd be easy on him. We gave him 3 minutes, and at first, a couple of young men went over, and they tried to move his arms, and I'll never forget the look on their faces. They could not budge his arms. And they called over a couple of more, and a couple of more, and pretty soon the whole class, they gave up trying to move his body. They tried to just move an arm. They gave up trying to move an arm. They tried to bend a finger, and it did not happen. With the power of probably 12, maybe 15 students, in unison, we could not budge our instructor from that spot. For all intents and purposes, he was one with the floor, and his arms were in a fixed position that would not move, and we were amazed. And we sat back in silence. In a few moments, he took a deep breath, and he opened his eyes, and he explained what had happened, because we asked. We said, how'd you do that? And he said, I had the feeling of what it would feel like. I envisioned chains moving from the edges of my hands to the tallest mountains on either side of my body. and my body being anchored firmly to this place in the earth. I envisioned that in my mind, and then I felt what it would feel like if that were so. And I knew that if that were so, that nothing could move me. And that's why in those moments you could not move me from this place. And he was sharing this with this group of 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old students to impress upon us this inner gift that we have. Some call it a power. This technology, as he aligned his thought, feeling, and emotion, he thought what it would be like, then he had the feeling and the emotion of that having happened, and then he gave thanks. He allowed for the possibility for what he had created in that moment. It had taken him years of training to reach that point. And it was in that moment that something changed in me, and something clicked. And it was a very ancient memory of even more, even greater things that we have within us. When thought, feeling, and emotion become as one, that is when we are most potent, enabled, and empowered to move forward in our world. What virus could stand up to that force, to that power? What healing could not happen in the presence of that force? How do we elicit that force and focus it in our bodies? How do we call forth the honoring of our relationship between us and the creative forces of our world? Some people call it God. This is the God energy, the potential, the force that we are that spark of that moves through us in those moments. Now the Essenes share their wisdom as we align thought, feeling, and emotion. We got the thought part down really well. In the thinking process, it simply is incomplete. And as we allow for the possibility of feeling and emotion to become part of this technology, it's almost frightening for some people when they consider the power, the potential that lives within their bodies. So the power of peace. Isn't it interesting that so much attention now is being focused on the power of peace in our world? And if peace is ever going to become the reality that we choose, now is the time. And if we're going to be in prayer, why not pray from the most potent form of prayer that we have available to us, from the fifth mode of prayer, the mode that invites us to come from the place that what we're choosing to have has already happened. And in doing so, we're creating the template of that possibility, and that's what allows it to be real. The question then comes up, the next question, how is it that we have that feeling of peace in our world when sometimes we don't see that? What do we use as a reference? If we're choosing to have peace right now and we're in the middle of a civil war somewhere in Africa or somewhere in Europe, where do we find that peace? In the Essenes, once again, they remind us, we come back to them again and again, always have the brothers and sisters of light lived where rejoice the angels of the earthly mother, near trees, rivers, near flowers, near the music of the bird, where the sun and the rain embrace their bodies, which is the temple of their spirit. This is where we're invited to go for our reference of peace, back to nature. And once we find that peace in nature, we have a feeling in our bodies. Sometimes it's a feeling you don't even recognize. We often will take groups out into nature. And something happens as people take those first few steps through the valley and they look at the lush green forests or the deep blue skies or the snow-capped mountains of 20,000 feet surrounding them, the clarity of the glacial lakes, they'll take a deep breath. And with that deep breath, I see an expansion. They begin to open up from within. And that is them feeling that feeling of peace that nature gives them. I mean, that's why we're drawn to go back into nature so frequently. And the reverence that comes from that, our time in nature, is where we're invited to create the reference of peace. Give it a name. Give that feeling a name. Bring it into our lives. And now walk forth into a world where we may believe maybe peace doesn't exist and call that feeling back to us once again and have peace. Whether or not we find it in the world around us, that is the beginning of a powerful technology. A very powerful technology. We're invited to look to nature. The reason that I believe this is so important at this time in history, now let's go back and look at a little context. I have something I'd like to share with you. In the midst of all the prophecies we began with just a little while ago, I shared with you the Hopi prophecy and the Mayan traditions, and I shared one from the book of Revelation from the prophet John. As we see it in the translation after 1700 years ago, and again, we get the Reader's Digest condensed version, we get the vision that John saw of all the catastrophic destruction of Earth as we turned our back on the natural forces of creation, on the wind, on the earth, on the water, on the power of the sun, the energy that powers our technology at this time in history. Well, there's another portion of that prophecy that was left out of the translations, and I'd like to share this with you because it's the other side, it's the flip side of the possibility as John saw it. And it's a powerful message of hope and possibility. So in the Essene text, the Essene book of Revelations, translated again from the original Aramaic without the deletions, without the condensations, what has happened is John has been taken in the dream to see all of the catastrophic destruction that could come to pass. And he is just appalled. He's shocked. He's hurt. And he drops to his knees and says, is there anything that can be done to change this? And the angel that's showing him this in his dream says, there's always hope. There's always possibility. It only takes one person. And after he said that, and now I'll read directly from the texts, John saw something different. He says, then I saw not what befell the children of the earth, for then my vision changed, and I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away. And in the new heaven and the new earth, the children of the earth wiped away all of the tears from their eyes. And in this new heaven and new earth, there was no more death. There was no more sorrow. None were crying. There was no more pain, for the former things had all passed away. Those who made war had beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation did not lift up sword against nation, neither did they learn war any more, for the former things had all passed away. And then again my vision changed, and I heard the voices of the sacred brotherhood raised in the song. And the song said, come, John, walk with us in the light, in the law that honors all. And from within myself, I heard my voice say, I have reached the inner vision, and through the Spirit in me, I've heard the wondrous secrets. Through the mystic insight, thou hast caused a spring of knowledge to well up within me, a fountain of power pouring forth living waters, a flood of love and all-embracing wisdom, for the former things had passed away. That's a message of hope and possibility. John witnessed a parallel possibility that was left out of our texts. And in that possibility, we have a memory of a greater possibility for this time in our history. Almost universally, as we witness the things in this world that most often we would choose to change, hunger, illness, sickness, war, catastrophic disasters, the root that we have the opportunity to redefine is the ancient code of peace that the Essenes reminded us of so eloquently. Peace, they say in their writings, is the key to all wisdom, to all knowledge, to all mystery, to all life. Peace. So perhaps the most effective prayer that we may offer at this time in our world, if we choose to participate in this fifth mode of prayer, is to simply feel the feelings, to become that peace in our bodies that we choose to have in our world. And in that peace, we end the starvation, we end the sickness, we end the warfare, we end the judgment between peoples of all worlds. So I'll invite you to join me as we embrace the possibility of the fifth mode of prayer. I invite you to join me and participate in calling forth that part of us, that ancient memory in the midst of our collective history that beckons to us to create the peace in our bodies and know that that peace is mirrored in the world around us. The lost mode of prayer, the fifth mode of prayer. Rather than ask that this peace come to pass, we're invited to create the peace in our bodies through the ancient technology of imagination, thought, feeling, and emotion. So if you'd like to close your eyes, maybe take a deep breath. Feel the expansiveness of that breath as you exhale. And in this moment, create the peace in your body that you choose to see, to feel, and to experience in our world. And in doing so, know that it has already happened. It's already done on some level. The moment you think, feel, and emote that peace, you've planted the seed and it's happened. Now your prayer becomes the opportunity to feel what it feels like in your world with the peace that you've created. So take this peace, feel it for our world. And may we bring peace to all. We give thanks for this opportunity to share together in creating this template of peace. And then this becomes our lost mode, our fifth mode of prayer.
This concludes The Lost Mode of Prayer, flute music by Greg Braden. For more information on programs and workshops with Greg Braden, please contact Sacred Spaces Ancient Wisdom, P.O. Box 5182, Santa Fe, New Mexico, 87502, or call 505-424-6892. To order additional copies of this audio program, or to receive a free catalog of Wisdom for the Inner Life, please visit Sounds True at www.soundstrue.com or call Sounds True 800-333-9185 or write the Sounds True catalog, P.O. Box 8010, Boulder, Colorado 80306. Thank you for listening.